Our retired explorer dines with Michel Foucault in Paris, 1961, by the Weaker Thans. Just one more drink, and then I should be on my way home. I'm not entirely sure what you're talking about. I've had a really nice time, but my dogs need to be fed. I must say that in the right light, you look like Shackleton. Comment allez-vous ce soir? Je suis comme ci, comme ça. Yes, a penguin taught me French back in Antarctica. Oh, I could show you the way the shadows colonize snow. Ice breaking up on the bay off the Lassiter coast. Light failing over the pole as every longitude leads. Up to your frost-bitten feet. Oh, you're very sweet. Thank you for the flowers and the book by Derrida. But I must be getting back to dear Antarctica. Say, do you have a ship and a dozen able men that maybe you could lend me? Oh, Antarctica. Oh, Antarctica. Oh, Antarctica. Oh, Antarctica.
This episode of The Harmonious Gentleman is brought to you by our friends at Blind Man Brewing, makers of Central Alberta's best craft beer, purveyors of delicious tacos, and hosts of all kinds of harmonious fun. They don't like to brag about it, but they've won Brewery of the Year in Alberta and Best in Show at the Canadian Brewing Awards. Head to Lacombe and check them out.
If podcast episodes were the age that Bilbo Baggins turned on the night of his farewell birthday, the night that he gave Frodo the One Ring, you'd know this has to be episode 111 of The Harmonious Gentleman. I'm Chris.
I'm Tyler.
I am Graham.
Isn't it the, I'm going to say it wrong, but the 11th and 1st?
111st. 111st. Yeah, he calls it his 111st.
Yeah.
Nice.
Which is coincidentally also the day that Frodo turned 33. I didn't know that it was also his coming of age birthday at the same party.
The same day?
Yeah.
Oh.
Seems like kind of weak writing.
I don't think Peter Jackson's adaptation conveyed that very well.
I agree. That must be a book thing, or maybe it's in the Silmarillion.
Do you guys like those movies?
Yeah. Yes, like, they're my favorite three movies of all time.
Okay, so you like them a lot?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, very good.
What about the Hobbit ones?
Not my least favorite three movies of all time, but close.
Have you watched them more than once?
No.
I didn't get to the third movie, but I think it's because I liked the book so much that the...
Yeah,
my standards were quite high for the film, and I liked the Lord of the Rings films, so it was,
yeah,
it was tough to get through.
I kind of felt the third one, Hobbit, was kind of unwatchable. Like, I think I tried,
yeah,
but it was just a, like, kind of a disaster.
I definitely went to it in the theater, but
yeah,
wasn't super impressed.
I'll tell you what I am impressed with is our guest today coming up.
Oh man,
and that
you
that,
should be
that intro, Chris, actually works because The Lord of the Rings and The Hobbit are both very much about adventure.
Yes.
Right? Stepping outside your front door, yeah, embracing that adventure. And we're going to be very shortly joined by Brian Keating. He's not a hobbit,
wow,
but he's an international tour guide, adventurer, naturalist, speaker, writer, broadcaster. He does lots of things.
Yeah. Yeah.
And we'll let him introduce himself a little more after the break.
How do we just... How do we get this awesome guest, Tyler? How did this come to be?
Well, you just got to ask.
Mm-hmm.
I just went to his website, sent him an email.
Yeah.
Replied to the email, made a phone call.
So you didn't even have to deal with a booking agent or anything?
No.
Wow.
And it worked.
Before we jump, like, we can, he's not here yet.
Yeah.
We have a few moments just to relax as gentlemen.
That's true.
How'd you guys enjoy having Kenton on last time?
That was great.
Yeah.
He came very well prepared, I thought.
Yeah.
And yeah, repaired, which is what I almost said.
Yeah, I liked that. I thought, going into it, I thought maybe it would be a little more contentious.
Mm-hmm.
But he said he provided a lot of information that was just information, right? It was good to know.
Yeah.
Provided a good context for that conversation.
Yeah.
Yeah. So thanks again to Kenton. That was really sweet.
Cool. Yeah. And for meeting us out of his hometown.
Yeah. Now, what was the place called that we met at? Do you guys remember what it was called?
Bean...
Brokers, Bean
nice
Brokers.
Job. You guys are just, your money is what you are. Mm-hmm. Speaking of money, we should probably take a break.
Make some.
Okay, we'll come right back with...
Brian Keating.
That's right.
Keating.
Keating.
Keating, all not right. Keaton.
This segment is brought to you by Cilantro and Chive. Delicious and creative dishes, a huge variety of locally crafted drinks, and building community in Red Deer and Lacombe. They're the gents' favorite place to grab a bite.
Hey listeners, just wanted to give a shout out to a friend of the show and friend in life, Peter P. He's been struggling lately with a recent diagnosis of leukemia, and we wanted to do a little bit of a contest with our listeners and raise some awareness for blood donation. So we are encouraging everybody to go and donate blood wherever you do that, wherever you live. When you do, let us know, and we're going to enter your name for a small prize package from Blind Man Brewing. We can't wait to hand that out, and we really want to give our love and prayers and thoughts to you, Peter. Get well.
So welcome, Brian.
Well, thanks, Tyler.
Who are you? Where do you come from, and where are you going? I told you it'd be quick.
Yeah, no, that's good. That's good. I like quick. I started as a bird watcher at age 12.
Oh, wow.
And that's what got me interested in the outdoors, and it just gave me an excuse, I guess, to go and explore different habitats. And the more I got into it, the more fun it became, and it just pulled me all over the place. Unfortunately, somebody in high school found out I was a bird watcher, so I was labeled Birdman for the rest of my high school years, and I couldn't wait to leave high school. Then I went off to college and university, and I found out there was a lot of other geeks like me. So it's been a happy story, and I worked with the Canadian Wildlife Service for a number of years in southern Saskatchewan and in southern BC, and that gave me access and reasons to learn about the natural world around me. Mm-hmm. I was working with the Wildlife Service in interpretive centers, So essentially educational centers, trying to get people interested and curious about nature.
And was that in Alberta?
Southern Saskatchewan for, I think I was there for about 3 years. I was the assistant manager of the Wildlife Center, which is now defunct, but it was about 18 kilometers this side of Swift Current. Okay. And then I started in Creston, BC, which I always wanted to work in the mountains, and the mountains around Creston weren't the mountains I envisioned. I wanted mountains like Jasper and Banff, but nearby there was places like Kokanee, the Selkirk Mountains and the Purcell Mountains, and I got big into mountaineering, and that interest also followed me for most of my life. Cool. But so then I ended up at the Calgary Zoo, primarily because my girlfriend got into university in Calgary, and I was in Saskatchewan, and long distance relationships are great until they're not. And so I managed to get a job at the Calgary Zoo as their director of education. And I was with them for almost 30 years, half that time as the director of education, the other half in charge of their conservation outreach organization, which I was the founding director of. So I started the whole project. And that brings me to today, where I retired from the zoo about a decade ago, maybe a little bit longer. But I never really slowed down. I still do what I did before, except I don't have to do budgets. And I don't have to go to meetings. So I'm my own boss now. And my wife and I then have taken up what essentially all the fun bits that I used to do. We continue to do that to today.
Right. What are some of those fun things?
Well, last week I was in the Antarctic. Last week I was in Chile, but the previous 3 weeks to that I was in the Antarctic, and I started leading trips down to the Antarctic. I think it was 2020, and then I gradually was able to get a very part-time job on a ship, leading groups down to the Antarctic, and that's what allowed me to get down there year after year. And I would only do one, two, or three trips in a row, so some of these trips were quite short, maybe 8 days, so they would be a down and back to the peninsula. Some of them were quite long, like the one I just did, 3 weeks, where we go to the Falkland Islands and to South Georgia, the island archipelago that Ernest Shackleton made so famous, and then down over to the peninsula, and those are the trips that I really enjoy, the ones where you can really get involved and get embedded into that kind of ecosystem. Mm-hmm. But so that's where I just was.
Cool. And yeah. When I was looking at your I think it's your website, Going Wild.
Yep.
It looks like you've done a lot with film, TV and radio.
Yeah, you know, that was, I guess, a natural progression. I started in radio years and years ago, probably 4 decades ago, and with CBC, and I've had a regular weekly segment on their show, and it's always about nature or wildlife discovery or exploration or adventure. And I guess it was a natural progression. I got my first single lens reflex camera at age 12. That's what slowed me down, in fact, and that's what made me look at things. And then I had this moment where I thought I wanted to be a wildlife photographer, and I wanted my pictures on the front cover of Audubon magazine. Mm-hmm. And my first pictures that came back, I realized there was a long,
a
bit of a process there. But it gave me some direction. It slowed me down, and my first pair of binoculars also slowed me down, and then the rest is essentially history.
Okay. I feel like a lot of our listeners, Brian, will recognize your voice because they've probably heard you weekly on CBC. What I always found fascinating about those spots was sometimes you're talking about swallows or bat boxes or the beetles in your yard, and other times you're in Rwanda trekking with gorillas, and you kind of never know where Brian's going to be.
Are you saying that I have a short attention span?
I don't know, but I was always jealous, I think, of, oh man, the adventures he's on week to week are just unbelievable.
You know, Chris, it's amazing the world we live in. And it's it's, you know, I'm not a wealthy individual, but what I've done is used my knowledge that I've gained from when I first started birdwatching at age 12 to apply to the concept of tour guiding. That's what's given me the opportunity. That's what sort of made the highway that led me into all these different areas. And of course, communication too, being able to talk to the public about the wonders of nature. Yeah. So that combined with a skill that I've been working on since age 12 has allowed me to go and explore those places. And there's so much out there, and we are so lucky we live in this part of the world where we have the Rocky Mountains at our doorstep and the prairies on the other direction. We've got all these fantastic canoeable rivers, places to hike, you know, and still a relatively small human density, although that's changing rapidly. But you know, we have this incredible backyard. And I just feel incredibly lucky because of that.
I think what's also amazing about you is the way you're just as excited about purple martins as you are about whatever, Arctic terns or, you know, these faraway adventures that seem much bigger. But you make the backyard also seem kind of like an adventure. So,
well, thanks, Chris.
Kudos to you.
Where are you going from here?
I became a fellow of the Canadian Geographical Society, the Royal Canadian Geographical Society, a few years ago. Both my wife and I are fellows, and we, part of that, you know, designation is that they expect you to do some volunteer work. So I'm volunteering on a ship. It's not necessarily my type of travel, but I'm looking forward to it. It's on a big cruise ship, a Cunard ship, from Vancouver to Alaska and back, and I'm one of their guest speakers. So that's the price that I pay for being on the ship, but I'm doing it under the umbrella of the Canadian Geographical Society. Okay. And so I've got that happening in the spring, in June. And then in August, I'm joining a Cork expedition as a guide, but for a group of Calgarians. So there's 24 of us, I think, that are going on that trip on a ship that holds about 100 people. And we'll be going up as far north as we can. We're starting in Resolute Bay and trying to get up to perhaps halfway up Ellesmere Island, if the ice allows us to do that.
Okay.
And the Arctic has been a very strong interest of mine since I was 21, when I spent 4 months up there working as a handyman at a weather station. So I was washing the dishes and scrubbing the floors and cleaning the urinals, not necessarily in that order, on a weather station. And that being there, though, gave me access to this unbelievable Canadian wilderness. So the Arctic is a very sincere interest of mine and has been for a long time. And then in September, I'm taking another group back to Africa, this time to Kenya.
Awesome.
When you travel, is it always with the purpose of studying something, or are these recreational trips for people who just like having you along to tell you about all the highlights?
I'm the naturalist. So I'm the guide, essentially. And because a lot of these places I've been to time and time again, I've been traveling to Africa for a long time. It's been a yearly migration, except during the COVID difficulties. But it's been an annual migration for my wife and I, and we've had a very, very sincere interest in discovering different places in Africa for a long, long time. So people look at my wife and I as the experts that go along on the trip, and that's the role that we fill. Also troubleshooter if things go wrong. And so it's I wouldn't call it a holiday for me, but it's definitely an adventure. And it seems that these types of trips select for good people. You know, I've rarely had a bad apple on one of these trips. They tend to be good people with an interest in life. A lot of them have had life experience, so they know they can compare a given trip to other trips that they've had in the past, so they know what quality is. Mm-hmm. And we tend to take trips to some of the best places in the world for wildlife watching.
Yeah.
This segment is brought to you by Veldhuizen Construction. They have been building incredible homes for over 30 years. The Veldhuizen team will guide you step by step through the design and build process. The finished product will be your design, your selections, your beautiful home. If you're looking to build in central or northern Alberta, call today to get started. Go to veldhuizen.ca or see the show notes to get in touch.
So, Brian, how would you say, like, you're going on these trips, sounds great, every couple of months. How do you pay those bills? How do you make a living amongst, you know, that lifestyle?
Well, you know, there's no doubt about it. You don't make a lot of money when you do this stuff. But I run the trips not because for any financial gain. It's because I really enjoy doing them. Yeah. And it does give me the fodder to organize and create the presentations that I do. So Graham, I've got a number of different talks that I do. I'm basically, when people ask me how I make my living, I say, well, I lead trips and I give talks. Mm-hmm. So I'm a professional speaker, mm-hmm. and I'm registered with 3 or 4 or 5 speaking agencies across the country. In a pre-COVID year, I would do maybe 50 presentations a year.
Wow. Yeah.
So that's about one a week on the average. But then you condense that into the time that I'm around, and sometimes it's 2 a week, and sometimes even more, because up until COVID, I was sometimes away out of the country for up to 6 months out of the year running these trips. So these trips give me the fodder and give me the theme in many cases to create some of these presentations that I do. And all the presentations I do have obviously a natural history theme, because that's my gig.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But I see that you've done one called A Natural Relationship in the past. And I also heard in one of the videos I was watching from Going Wild, I believe, where you said something about being in nature or being with these creatures, we get to know ourselves better.
Yeah.
Is that intrigued me, and I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, well, thanks for that, Tyler. Yeah, you know, I have, because I've been so focused on being outside for most of my life, since I started bird watching, and I've married a woman who is has the same interest level as me, we both find that we're the best when we're away from the busy city systems. I mean, we live in the city, we live in Calgary, we live near the core, we really do feel our best when we're out there. And sometimes when we feel like we've bitten off more than we can chew, we look at each other and we say, all I want to do is go camping, you know, because it's life can be so simple when you're away from the busyness of our society. You get away from the electronics, you know, we're all so tied. And believe me, I like my phone as much as anybody else does, and I love my iPad, but I think it's important to break yourself away from that. And so that talk that you refer to, natural relationships, is the relationship that I believe all of us strive to get to, that relationship with nature. I think that we are genetically programmed to appreciate blue sky, the sound of running water, the color green. You know, this busy city system that we now all find ourselves very much tied to, and we all enjoy it to a certain degree. I'm not sure how healthy it is for all of us. And I know that there's lots of statistics about how kids have a rough time these days with obesity, with attention deficit, with, there's so many factors that really can be tied right back to Richard Louv's philosophy, the fellow who wrote the book Last Child in the Woods, which I actually have a copy of that book with me today. The Last Child in the Woods, which was written over a decade ago, talks about the fact that kids aren't getting outside as much anymore. And they've lost that connection to that natural relationship. And I believe it's important that we find that connection and nurture that connection. I don't think we think about nature enough. I don't think we talk about nature enough. I don't think we're in nature enough. Can you imagine for a moment, Tyler, what life would be like if we were as into nature as we are into technology?
It'd be different.
Holy cow.
Because we're not even close.
Totally. And I think that you know, for businesses and for organizations, if we pay attention to nature, I think we'll be better business people. I think we'll be more considerate of decisions we have to make, which will ultimately affect the environment we live in. I think we have to tread with a much more sensitive, holistic walk on this planet. We have just surpassed 8 billion people. There has never been a time more important than now to get our act together and make sure that we don't mess up this still beautiful world that we live in. And that's what natural relationships is all about. And I use a few really fun video segments in that. One of my styles of giving these presentations is to show a video and live narrate over it, so that that way I can change my narration to whatever audience I'm with. You know, if it's a group of kindergartners, it's going to be a lot different than if I'm speaking to a business group in downtown Toronto.
Right.
And so I can, and it also makes it relevant and real and right now when I do that. And having the moving image in front really attracts people's attention. And some of the videos I've managed to shoot over the years are just downright damn funny. And it's great to add that kind of humor into a presentation. And I try to bring that in with natural relationships. Actually, with all of my presentations, I try to bring that in.
Are you seeing, Brian, in places you're traveling to, that there are some countries doing a better job of returning to nature, or is that, or incorporating it in their business practices, or the way cities are developed, or like, are you seeing that happening anywhere where it's done really well?
You know, I think one would, to be fair to answer that question properly, one would have to live in places for a period of time to really get a feel for it. But I was just down in Chile, down in southern Chile. I just spent the last week there after I came out of the Antarctic. My wife rented a cabin in the woods with an airtight fireplace, and we enjoyed Patagonia full on with horizontal rain and wind the first night, and then some blue sky weather over the next few days. But that part of the world, two-thirds of the landscape is protected landscape.
Wow.
And it's an area the size of Britain, and that's 20% of Chile. So here in one tiny little part in Chile, they've managed to put aside two-thirds of the landscape.
Wow.
And the national parks that have been created in the last decade or so down there, they're striving to create connectivity between them all, so that whatever wildlife is there can move between these wild areas. And where we were, it's kind of the Chilean's backyard playground for those that like adventure and adventure travel. So I think there are examples of places that are trying to do it right. Amazingly, Chile's conservation success relates to a United States businessman who made his money in selling outdoor clothing, Patagonia, and he has used his life wealth to buy up landscapes.
Really?
And then he donated
that. That's really cool. That's great to hear that.
I know. It's amazing. And he donated it back to the Chilean government. I'm sure there are many legal contracts putting it all together, but holy cow, talk about an amazing commitment. So, that brings us back to the concept that an individual who has some kind of connection to nature can actually move mountains.
Yeah.
And he literally has.
Wow.
Yeah.
And listeners, I'm sure, can hear this, but I've read this about you too, that you've been accused of having a very positive outlook. When it comes to this, the change or the way we're evolving to becoming less connected with nature, do you have a positive outlook about that?
You know, I think it would be hard to survive in this world, in the business I'm in, without looking at the optimistic side of things. Mm-hmm. I see good things happening. There's a lot of good people out there making things happen. I've got lots of conservation connections to individuals that are moving mountains, that are doing amazing things. You know, collectively, I think we're losing the race, but we have to try, and we have to do as best we can, and hopefully there'll be enough of these wild areas that are put aside. I mean, look at Canada's effort right now for putting aside 30% of the landscape by 3050 or 3030. I think it's 30% by 3030. And we're not anywhere near there yet. I think we're at 22% or something like that. But we are making strides, and the present government is committed to trying to get there. Mm. So there are good things happening. There's no doubt about it. I mean, we have huge issues in front of us right now. Probably the most serious one our society is facing is global warming. Mm-hmm. And believe me, I see the effects of global warming. People ask me, do you see it in the Antarctic? Well, let me tell you, Tyler, I see it big time. Mm-hmm. It's right in front of my face every time I go down there. Yeah. But I think that this is the big challenge of today's society. We have to work together, and we got to work hard like we've never worked before to pull this together and try to mitigate the issues that are in front of us right now. So yeah, I'm positive for sure. I think if I was pessimistic, I would just clam up and go and play on my own and just enjoy the rest of my life.
Live in that cabin in Patagonia.
Bingo. Man, was it ever good, let me tell you.
This segment is brought to you by the King's University in Edmonton, Alberta, offering an exceptional liberal arts education from a Christian perspective. King's degree programs integrate internships, work learning, study abroad experiences, and research opportunities. The King's University, bright hope for tomorrow.
Well, I don't know if this is going to be like a lightning fire round of questions, Brian, but one question I've often thought about your answer to was what's your favorite animal?
You know, Chris, that's the standard question I get from kids.
Okay.
But it's great. It's a great question because, and this is where we come back to one of my earlier comments. I think I've got a short attention span because my favorite animal is the animal I'm watching at the time. Whether it's a Richardson ground squirrel doing its thing or a giraffe when I'm in Africa. You know, what I really like about travel and nature watching is that you can be in the moment. And think about how you operate your days these days. Right now, you're always planning for what's happening in the next hour or tomorrow or next week. You're working to deadlines. You're marking school papers. You've got all these pressures. When you get out and you've got your binoculars and your significant other or you're by yourself, which, you know, in years past, I've spent a lot of time on my own just out there watching nature, you get totally involved with watching whatever it is. I've made a point of biking to a place in Calgary along Deerfoot Trail in the spring just to park my bike and then sit and watch the gophers' goofy behaviors. Mm. Richardson ground squirrels have a remarkable life history, especially in the spring when the males are coming out. All they're doing is fighting, and it's quite interesting to watch. That's testosterone. That's high school Friday night right there.
Yeah.
And of course they're waiting for the females to emerge so that they can complete the cycle.
Show off a little. Yeah.
Yeah, that's right. But anyway, the answer to that is when I'm whatever animal I'm with, it's that at that point it's my favorite animal. But to be honest, I have to say it's the big-brained creatures that intrigue me the most. Mm-hmm. So the whales, which include dolphins and the primates, but specifically the greater primates like the gorillas and the chimpanzees, creatures that basically have a complex social system. Mm. Elephants, for instance. I have spent thousands of hours watching elephants and in the wild, and even followed them as they moved through the bush. And it's to be that close to elephants, to watch their behaviors. They're always doing something. They're always manipulating the environment, picking up a stick, or even painting, you know, doing drawings with their trunk in the sand when they're bored, playing with each other, pushing each other around, altering their environment. Those types of creatures really turn my crank, and that's where I tend to gravitate to.
That's awesome.
So you've had probably countless, experiences with animals close by. Has there ever been one that sticks out in your mind that was the most scared you were or dangerous?
That's another question that every student asks.
Thank you.
And what I don't like doing is scaring kids.
Yes.
But you know what? If I was a taxi driver and I was out on the road all the time, I bet you I could tell you a lot of stories about near misses and maybe a few hits.
Yeah.
You know, driving is, I always remind people that the most dangerous thing we do is get in the car every day. The stuff that I do is, give me an honest lion any day and I'll sort it out.
Yeah.
But I have had close encounter simply because of the volume of time I've spent in the woods. And we did have a lion attack us once, but that was our mess up. We screwed up. We walked into his pride with their cubs, and it was on a steep embankment. The male lion attacked, and fortunately I was carrying a bear banger, and we escaped quite literally within fractions of a second.
Wow.
And there was three of us, my wife, a very good friend of mine, and me. And we were very, very lucky. And sometimes I tell that story, but I don't like to tell it because it scares people. Mm-hmm. And of all the other lion encounters I've had, they've all been good. Mm-hmm. And it was my screw up.
Yeah.
I walked into a pride, and I should have been more... I should have had the foresight, I guess, to assume that they may be in that little hidden mm-hmm. valley that we walked right up to.
Okay.
And I had a hippo bite my canoe once and put us in the drink. But I had a half gallon of fiberglass repair material and a newspaper sheet worth of fiberglass. And my wife and I had it fixed within a couple of hours. And before we got back into the canoe, we gave each other a hug. We were on a 10-day trip from Lake Kariba down to Mozambique. By ourselves, and we were illegal immigrants at that point on the Zambian side.
Okay.
So because that's where the hippo bit us, and that's where we ended up on the shore.
Wow.
But we did get out of that, and it was because of good planning. And there, you know, the reason why that's probably never happened when I've been with groups on that river is because we're always talking, or somebody taps their paddle against the side of the boat. But my wife and I like to travel silently. Mm-hmm. That's the best way to wildlife watch, and it quite literally bit us.
You're right in the canoe.
And we had a buffalo once decide that he didn't like the looks of us and went after us. That was in Africa. We've had a few others. But, you know, it's because you look at all the time. I mean, I'm 68 years old now, and you look at all the years that I've spent. I've been doing this since my 20s and going to Africa since my mid-20s on a yearly basis. And we've done a lot of solo travel in Africa, too. And over those years, we've traveled with some of the best guides, and we've learned how to not be stupid. And for the most part, we've been able to pull that off. But just like anything in life, you're going to have slip-ups.
Yeah.
I don't know if this will be the third most common question that students ask you.
But,
what's a moment that you've witnessed where you couldn't believe that you get to witness it? Like, it's like a magical or an experience where you're just in awe. You can't believe that you're there to witness it.
Yeah, you know, there's a few different examples, Tyler. I think probably one of the earliest ones was going to East Africa and seeing the wildebeest migration. Hmm. You know, looking out, we came up onto a hill and we looked out over at least 100,000 wildebeest. Hmm. And, you know, there's something like 2 million wildebeest that live in the Serengeti ecosystem now. There may have been a 500,000 that we were looking at, but I don't know how to count higher than 100,000 quickly. but to be there and to look at that, it made me think, what would it have been like to have been here in our prairies 150 years ago when we had all the bison that we had and the pronghorn antelope and the elk and the grizzly bears? I mean, it was just the turn of the last century that some surveyors near Medicine Hat sighted something like 8 or 9 or 10 grizzly bears feeding on Saskatoons on the other side of South Saskatchewan River Valley. You know, so we had incredible wilderness here not that long ago, and to be in something like a group of wildebeest and look over and sort of think about what we used to have here. That's an awesome moment to pause. And then, you know, even as recently as 2 weeks ago, we were unable to land on a king penguin colony in South Georgia, the island archipelago that's inside the ecosystem of the Antarctic, because it's on the far side of the what they call the Antarctic convergence. So it's in the Southern Ocean itself. That's why there's so much life there, because of all the krill that's in the ocean around the islands. And we were unable to land because bird flu has found its way to South Georgia, which could be a huge ecological issue in the coming months or years. But we were able to zodiac just a few meters offshore on an incredibly calm blue sky day. And we did the whole 3 kilometer zodiac along the beach of nothing but king penguins. And so the beach was lined with king penguins, and we looked off into the distance for acres and acres and acres of king penguins up to the cliff and the glacial walls far behind. The sounds, the sights, the penguins coming in past us, landing on the beach, other penguins walking in, you know, with waves crashing against them, and it was profound, and that gives me incredible pause. And then last November, I was in Zimbabwe. And, you know, Zimbabwe's had a lot of troubles, political troubles, but there's been some seriously good conservation work done in that country over the last couple of decades. And I was at one camp. We got there at about 4 o'clock in the afternoon in Hwange National Park, which is their largest national park. We drove into the camp, we got out of the vehicles, and I could hear already that stuff was happening. The camp itself is situated so everything faces a water hole. When we came around the corner and looked, there was about 400 elephants there.
Oh my.
And those elephants stuck around most of the night, and we none of us slept that night. And it would have been a shame to have slept because the volume of life that was you know, elephants stepping on other elephants' toes and the screaming and yelling and doing what elephants do. You know, there's socializing going on, trunk against trunk, and elephant groups that haven't seen each other for a while, and so there's lots of screaming, and it was profound. And that's a third example of that comes to mind.
Any more typical questions, you guys? Is that okay? No one asked
right
your
now
favorite place to go that you've been, but would you say that's where you are at any given time?
Well, no, not really. I, you know, people do ask me that question, and I always tell them that I'm living in it. No. You know, we are so lucky here in Alberta. We have so much at our doorstep. I started mountaineering in my high school years, and I've been doing it ever since. And, you know, you don't have to go far off the trail before you get away from people. Mm-hmm. You just have to be a little creative in how you do it and where you go. Mm-hmm. And so we still find the solitude that we really enjoy out there. And, so I would say that our own Western Canadian landscape is where it's at.
Brian, we used to have a family membership to the Calgary Zoo. Last night, I mentioned to my son Fisher, he's 26, so I hope I got that right, when the last time he had been to the Calgary Zoo, and he said, "Dad, I don't think you've taken us since we watched Blackfish," which I don't think those maybe kind of happened around the same time, but I don't think that was like an intentional decision. Mm. But I wanted to ask you your role at the Calgary Zoo, the importance of it over the years, and there's probably, well, I don't, it's not groundbreaking to say that there's controversy around zoos and how some animals are treated. What role do you see zoos having in the present day, and how do they do things ethically? And you're obviously still connected, so how does that all work?
Well, Chris, you know, I believe that there are some people that are beyond zoos because they already get it. But my experience is that a lot of people don't understand the importance of intact ecological systems. And zoos at least give a window into a bit of an understanding of how the world works and why it's important to care about how the world works from an ecological perspective. It's what keeps us alive. And so that's in the bigger picture. Now, there are some zoos that definitely need to be closed down right away.
Yeah.
I mean, there's...
Even in Alberta, and some that have.
Absolutely. Yeah. But the good zoos, and those are the zoos that are accredited and follow international rules or national rules that are created, they serve a purpose, and I think it's a very important purpose, because where else are kids or adults going to go to get inspiration on nature? If they're already going to national parks and hiking and exploring and bird watching, they're already there. Yeah. They don't need a zoo.
Yeah, that's right.
But the individuals, most people aren't there. And so I believe that the zoos offer an opportunity for people to gain a bit of an insight into the importance and the value of ecological integrity. Mm. And so also the Calgary Zoo has moved in the right direction, I think, since I left. They, you know, I've always said that the zoo should be putting in 50% of everything they've got into energy and efforts into ecological sustainability. So in other words, supporting the development of parks and protected areas, supporting research and science to gain more of an understanding of how we can protect endangered species and species that aren't endangered. Mm-hmm. And the zoo's done that. They call themselves the Wilder Institute/Calgary Zoo. So that's a huge philosophical change, and that's right from the board level. And I think it's moving where zoos should go, because all zoos should be putting in a tremendous amount of energy and effort into keeping our world a greener place. The Calgary Zoo now, I think they've got something like 30 research scientists working within their...
Yeah, wow.
When I left the zoo, there was one. That was me. So they've really moved into it in a big way, and they've developed funding sources for it that they don't have to depend upon great gate revenue too, which is good and proved very valuable mm-hmm. during COVID, for instance. Mm-hmm. Obviously, if a zoo doesn't have an educational department and they're not bringing in school kids as much as they can, they're not doing sleepovers, they're not doing outreach programs, they're not doing in situ scientific work, keeping the wildlife out there, then they don't belong to exist. Mm. They shouldn't exist. And that's part of the reason why accreditation is such a powerful tool.
I think for me too, zoos like fostered my love for animals. There's a quotation when you leave the Africa exhibit that says something like, when you pull at a single thread in nature, you find it's connected to the rest of the world. I probably butchered that quote.
No, that's good.
I really do see the value in that.
Oh, look what it does to kids. Look what it did to your kids.
Yeah,
you know,
absolutely.
It's amazing. And, you know, you talk to all the big scientists, and holy cow, they all remember their experiences when they were kids at zoos. Yeah. You know, and I remember when I was in kindergarten seeing a giant tortoise at a little community zoo where I grew up, and I can still visualize that tortoise like it was yesterday. I'm big into reptiles too, so. But
no shock there.
Yeah, someone great once said, "If I entertain people, they'll listen, and if they listen, they'll care."
Yeah.
Do you know who said that?
No, but Baba Diom, somebody or other, had some sort of.
I think you said
it. It was actually you. Oh. We found out.
Okay, well, I probably parroted it from that guy. Yeah.
Well, Chris, you said something about the thread, and some of the, threads of this conversation have led me to thinking about our connection to the natural world, and making a connection to spirituality and God. So Brian, this might be a little divergent from where we were headed, but are you a spiritual person? Do you see any connection between nature and a God, or where are you at with that stuff?
Well, you know, if you look back far enough, the whole discussion of God and spirituality entered all of the natural history realms during Darwin's time. You know, that was the big controversy of that time when he came up with the concept of natural selection changing creatures to be able to survive. So there was this argument has been around, or this discussion has been around for a long time. Personally, I'm not a religious person, but I believe I'm very much a spiritual person.
Yeah.
And there's no question about it. I feel much more connected when I'm out there in wild areas. Mm-hmm. And it gives me great satisfaction and great inner calmness when I'm out there. And my wife feels the same way. So we have a very strong spiritual connection to the natural world.
And in your travels, you've learned a lot about animals, but you've also learned about people,
yes,
right? And cultures. Is there any cultural group or religious group that you've admired?
You know, it's a good question, because a number of years ago, I went to northern India to look for snow leopards with Rodney Jackson, who is a very famous snow leopard guy. He's the one that started the Snow Leopard Conservancy, and he and his girlfriend are single-handedly responsible for probably saving thousands of snow leopards. He's an amazing individual. When we were hiking through some of the landscapes there, we spent 2 weeks looking for snow leopards, which, by the way, was outrageously successful. But we would encounter people working in the field, and I can't tell you how many times we'd be walking by somebody who's way on the other side of the little valley that we're in, and you'd hear them yell out, "Julie," which is hello, and they would wave, and we'd wave back in big smiles. And that's the Buddhist attitude, you know. And Buddhism is an amazing religion. They have a tremendous reverence towards all things living, and a great spiritual connection, I think, to those creatures. They used to look at the snow leopard, for instance, as a menace, because it would take the occasional goat or sheep, and that's an issue when you're a herder and you're depending upon your dozen or so sheep to keep you alive. But and then George Schaller brought in the concept of small numbers of people staying in what they call homestays with people up in some of these remote areas. And my wife and I stayed in one of the homestays. The cost for one night stay was something like $25, which basically gives the snow leopard, in a sense, quote, permission, unquote, to kill right. one of their sheep that yeah, year. Right. Oh, and wow. so the locals have learned that the people are coming because of snow leopards. And now they look at the snow leopard, instead of being a menace, they look at it as was quoted to me, the pearls in the necklace around the mountain. So, and you know, who but a Buddhist could come up with something like that, hey?
Yeah. It's very harmonious.
Yes. It sure is. Yeah.
Ryan, I saw also on your website that you have a talk on artificial intelligence and technology in the wild. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, you know, it was a cyber conference in Banff that I designed that talk for just maybe 4 or 5 months ago, and it went over really well. But then you have to remember that the people there is about 150, maybe 200 people there. They're all people that are working on computers every day, all day. So I think to talk about nature for a while was something that was out of their sphere, and it turned their crank. It was a lot of fun. But the theme of my story was how technology is being used to save animals, so we can better understand them, and so ultimately we can come up with plans that can better make sure that those populations don't disappear. And you know, I've been in the wildlife game for a long, long time, so I was out there with the Martin Yalkowski and the late Ian Ross looking for cougars that were collared, you know, in the 1990s, and then, you know, hunting one of the cougars down and tranquilizing it and replacing the collar. And so I've watched the evolution of these systems over the years, and I find it fascinating, and I find it exciting how miniaturization now, how battery longevity, how the use of solar panels. They've even got solar panels that they affix to the backs of Andean condors, because they're, you know, 15 hours a day they're floating around up in the sky with their wings outstretched. Why not take advantage of that sunlight?
What?
And so they can keep batteries powered for years on their trend, and they can follow where the Andean condors go. They know now how many are in Ecuador. They know where they go to breed. They know where they go to find their food, and they know what issues they are. In fact, I was with a condor expert, and this is part of the presentation. I was with a condor expert last year, and he said that he had had radio tracked about 20 condors in the 10-year span of time that he was doing this work, which dates right up to now. And he found one condor disappeared on a mountaintop. They went up, they found the condor that was giving the signal that it was stationary, and lo and behold, it had been poisoned because feral dogs. So these are domestic dogs gone wild, are running rampant throughout the mountains of Ecuador. They say that a government estimate puts them at about 200,000 dogs. Oh. And those dogs are out there killing everything to eat, to survive. So they're killing sheep and cows and you know, calves. And so farmers don't like them. But killing the dog is something that's kind of taboo in their society. Mm. But poisoning them, you know, then you don't have to be the one.
You don't see it. Yeah,
but right. You poison an animal to kill the dogs, and it has collateral damage. And these condors. So that immediately changed his focus. That technological opportunity changed his focus to what he had to do next, and that's to deal with the feral dog problem in Ecuador, and that's the project he's working on now. You know, maybe we don't have to kill them, but maybe we can fix them. You know, and let them continue to run, but they're only going to live then their
one generation.
One generation. Yeah. But anyway, so that's one example I use. But the miniaturization comes right here. I give one example that bird that's out at the Ellis Bird Farm.
Yeah.
The Purple Martin. Yeah. And her name was Amelia, and she was she had one of these tiny little tags attached to it. It's not a tag that transmits data, but it collects data. It collects sunrise, sunset, so you can work out the latitude and the longitude of where it is and at what time of the year. So they actually tracked that one single bird from Red Deer here all the way down to Brazil in the Amazon, where it hung around for a couple of months and then came back. And then they retrieved the tag from it and then analyzed the data. Man. And they figured out how long it took the bird to get down there and how long the bird took to get back.
Yeah.
That data tells us what areas we have to look at. You know, we're losing insectivorous birds at a significant percentage per year. So it's going to be important not only to rectify what the issues are here, which is probably related to pesticides or overuse of the landscape, but you know, that is all yet to be determined. But also that gives points of reference as to where these birds go on their trip down to the Amazon, areas that we then have to start looking at to make sure that we have protection systems in place so that these birds can safely move from one part of the world to the other. So I use that as an example of the technology. But also, you know, my gosh, there's so many dimensions to it. There's a type of swallow or type of swift in Africa called the alpine swift. It's about the size of a peregrine falcon. They attached a device onto that and followed it for a year and found that it was airborne for about 9 or 10 months out of the year. So it was not...
like without landing?
Without landing. It only landed to go and nest.
What?
Up in the higher elevations of Mount Kenya and Kilimanjaro and other places where these birds nest. They're a high elevation bird. And so not only were they living up there for 8 or 9 months at a time, but they were sleeping up there. They were feeding up there. They were drinking up there. They were bathing up there. They were mating up there. Mm. And that was all discovered by technology. By these little devices. And I can bring it even closer to home. In Banff, there's the black swift. And during COVID, I had the chance to walk up Johnson's Canyon, which I've ignored since my high school days.
It's been too busy.
Too many people. But one day we had the canyon essentially to ourselves. We counted about 10 other people. And that was early on in COVID when nobody was moving around. But that gave me the chance to stop and pause and look and examine every single bloody wall all the way up that canyon. Yeah. And I found two of the three nests of the black swift up there, one of the rarest birds probably in the world. And it's nesting in Johnson's Canyon. There's been a long-term study going on it. It's quite a famous bird. If you're a bird watcher, you would have heard about it. But I actually saw it clearly, closely, and was able to get full frame photographs of it on the nest. And on the nest, then I noticed there was a little plastic cap that looked like it was one of those old Kodak film canister caps.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
So I phoned up the chief park ecologist of Banff and I asked him what it was. It's a device that the researchers have put in there that measures the air temperature during the day and during the night. Yeah. And measures it every day throughout the year. And at the end of the year, they pick up that little device and they analyze that data. They're trying to learn more about what makes the black swift tick. And by using this technology, they're basically opening up a whole textbook example of investigation. And it's really exciting. So those are the types of technological tools. There's one, though, that I highlighted, and that's up in Churchill, Manitoba, following the polar bears. There was an article in the Globe and Mail last, I think it was September, so this was very relevant to my October or November talk, and it was by a so-called researcher who illustrated that maybe the polar bears are still there in good numbers, and they're just moving to other populations, and that the biologists are miscounting. Well, the biologist that has been working on the Churchill population has observed a 30% decline in that population in the last 15-20 years because of the effects of climate change, and he's also observed, because he's got data on something on dozens of polar bears, there's never been one polar bear that walked north and went to join another population. So using technology to dispel myths and fictitious information is really important, and that was part of the presentation.
That's really cool. I like the It's kind of a connection to what you said about the Buddhists and their view of the snow leopard here, because earlier on in the talk we talked about how technology and nature kind of being at odds, right? But now there's a connection there, right, where the technology may actually play a really important role in the sustainability of ecosystems.
Cool. Well, let's face it, it's an amazing world we live in, and we're learning more and more all the time and very rapidly now, and the advances in technology have enabled biologists to enter a whole new realm. I was with some research scientists in the Antarctic about 4 years ago. I went out with them for a day in one of the Zodiacs, and we darted about a half dozen whales to get little samples of their blubber. So we have this it's a crossbow, believe it or not, but with a highly sophisticated arrow that pulls out a plug.
Ejects itself, kind of?
It pulls out a plug of blubber from the whale. And from that blubber, of course, it's brought back to the lab, and they can look at toxins, and they can look at genetic health. They can look at all kinds of things with that. But, you know, talk about a technological opportunity there. That it's given us so much information on population dynamics, on population health, and it's, you know, using an 18th century or 14th century tool along with modern science, and not just that, but also attaching tags onto these whales too, and following those whales on their migrations. It's just opened up so much.
We usually end our episodes, especially when we have guests, with a segment about kind of living harmoniously or approaching whatever the topic is harmoniously. Do you have any advice for us and our listeners about that?
Yeah, you know, I do, actually, Tyler. That's a good question. A good friend of mine who worked with the on the environmental side of the government of BC, and he and I worked together years and years ago with the Canadian Wildlife Service. He attended one of my presentations, and he said, Brian, you know, it's nice that you give these nice talks on nature, and it gets everybody excited, but you need to give people a go-to idea, something that they can do that will make a difference. And his suggestion was to take a kid for a walk in the woods. Take a kid on a canoe weekend down a Saskatchewan or Alberta river. Basically get people out, not necessarily just kids, but get yourself out too. And you know, go for walks in the woods and just gain a bit of an appreciation for what we've still got. And that can only instill a sense of the need to make sure that we don't lose these areas.
Yeah, that's great. Thanks, Brian.
You're welcome.
Yeah, that was really great. Thanks for
it really was.
Chatting with us.
Yeah.
Well, thanks, gentlemen. That was a lot of fun. So, yeah, Chris, Tyler, and Graham, thanks ever so much.
Awesome.
Yeah, you bet. So what did you guys think about our conversation with Brian?
I was a very big fan. He was a wonderful man, wonderful conversation. It was great.
I've been a huge fan of his for a long time, just hearing his bits on CBC Radio. That's kind of the only way I've known him. But man, I just loved meeting him and hearing from him. It's awesome.
Yeah.
Thanks for arranging that.
Yeah, no problem. When I reached out to him, I didn't recognize the name at all. So then I was especially excited, Chris, when you, I think your response was, oh, this is 15 times better than getting like Bret Hart on or something like that.
Which is just so the universe knows, this is Graham's hope, is to get Bret Hart. Yeah. That's why I referenced Bret Hart.
He was Chris's Bret Hart.
Yeah.
But yeah, it was great.
I also he was here to do a talk, and we're just so appreciative of someone giving their time. Like he didn't have to do that. Like he just took an hour and a half out of his day to come meet us and gave us a wonderful talk. So thanks, Brian.
Yeah, so tomorrow he's doing a keynote for the teachers' convention here in Red Deer, and I think it'll be packed.
Yeah.
We'll be there.
It would be cool to hear him.
Okay, well, we're at the end of the episode where you guys need to recommend or confess something.
Sure.
So who's
going to go first? It's kind of a confession, sort of. Do you guys ever go on trips?
Say more.
Yeah. So we just got back from Phoenix. It was like a little family get together for 4 or 5 days. It was nice. But I find I do this thing on trips where, like, if something doesn't go right or there's some stress, sometimes, and you're a little extra tired because your days are long. I feel like this happens to me sometimes on trips where something doesn't go right and I have a hard time letting it go. And then I feel this pressure to, like, well, don't be bummed because you're on this trip and you got to make the best of the hours that you have.
Yeah.
Does that ever happen to you when you're on trips? Maybe it's not really a confession, but this happens not every trip, but like once in a while it'll happen.
So like it potentially could derail your
kind
whole
of,
trip?
And you're aware that it's kind of happening, and you're just thinking, oh, I don't want this to happen, but it's hard to get out of that funk or whatever, you know what I mean? Like the pressure.
Yeah. Anyway,
had a bit of a day like that on this trip. One of the days.
Where you let like a setback ruin your day.
Yeah. Yeah, something gets in your head, and it's like normally crap will happen day to day and whatever, but like when you're on a trip, I feel there's this extra pressure to like snap out.
Like it's got
to
be good,
right?
Yeah. Right, like the pressure to make your trip really good. Yeah. Those moments can feel even more devastating, even though they're not a big deal, maybe.
Yeah,
but that's my confession. I don't know how to. Yeah.
So I think it's relatable.
Yeah. How did that turn out? Did it ruin your whole trip?
No, it didn't ruin the whole trip. There was some time there. I was probably like not myself for a while. It was a great trip overall. It was really, really fun. In fact, recent guest Kenton was along for one of the days. Nice. Pretty cool hanging out. Yeah, nice. It's a good time. Anyway, that's my confession.
Okay, I hear you. I'm going to give you a recommendation. I did a small trip to Canmore Banff over the last few days. And just the little short hikes you can do nearby, there's so many. If you're on the All Trails app, which would be a tiny recommendation, get that app because it shows you all the hikes you can do. We did Grotto Canyon, which is close to Jura Creek. Both of those are near the town of Exshaw, which is just outside of Canmore in Kananaskis Provincial Park. And we also did Ribbon Creek and Troll Falls. Those are just short, fun. If you've got little kids, they're easy and perfect.
Yeah, they're great.
And it's just good to be out in nature.
Those are great recommendations.
After hearing everything Brian said and then that, like this weekend, we got to get outside and do something. Do a hike or something.
Do a hike.
Yeah. Cool. Well, that was really fun.
It was great.
Are you recommending or?
I don't really need to.
Oh, yeah, right.
We don't.
Sorry, you can edit that out, Graham.
No, it's fine. We're still getting used to our new format that's 11 episodes old. Awesome.
You guys coming to the big Bilbo party I'm having later? Celebrating his 111th birthday?
No, I can't. Did you notice Brian actually almost quoted the something from?
I thought he was going to,
but he didn't know we had talked about that before.
No, it just fit.
He said it's the most dangerous thing you can do is.
Yeah, like
the actual quote from, is it The Hobbit or Lord of the Rings?
I think that's in The Hobbit, but it might be when Sam and Frodo are talking in the beginning
of your front door.
Yeah,
he almost said that. And I thought that was another Buddhist connection.
Yeah.
Do you think Bilbo was a Buddhist?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah. If you want to tell Tyler he's wrong, you could email the show at harmoniousgentleman@gmail.com.
Yeah.
We're always open to corrective feedback, criticism, helpful advice.
Just anything.
Recommendations or a friendly hello.
Yeah.
Yeah, especially friendly hellos.
Yeah, they come pouring in. We don't always read them, but we read all of them and they're all great. So thank you.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, or you can find us on social media. Occasionally.
Occasionally.
Graham, what's your favorite animal?
Sasquatch.
Oh. Cool. Well. What about you, Chris?
Siberian tiger. They're not called that anymore. I forget what the new word is.
Okay.
So that's still
just
tiger.
It's just as real as mine then, I guess.
Yeah.
Do you have one, Tyler?
I like grizzly bear.
Mm-hmm.
Who would win in a fight between a Sasquatch, a grizzly bear, and a Siberian tiger?
Grizzly bear.
Yeah, I think grizzly bear. Well, tigers are pretty big.
I really loved his answer. Like, he doesn't want to ever scare anybody from adventuring and enjoying nature. So he didn't really want to talk about a dangerous encounter. But that's all I want to hear. I'm like, if you're seeking out these things, a gorilla's going to punch you.
Have
at
you
some
been
point.
Trampled by elephants or, yeah. You know? Bitten by a hippo was pretty intense.
Oh man, when I hear those stories, I don't think, well, I'm never going outside again. Like I just won't enter a lion encampment.
That's good advice.
Or canoe silently through hippo infested waters.
Yeah, that was freaky. I don't
even like going down the Red Deer River silently. Have you ever done that? It's like eerie. I don't know how Brian does that. It's impressive.
That's cool.
He's such like a quiet, like unassuming kind of guy, but he's, man, the adventures he gets to go on.
Cool. Yeah.
All right, guys. Let's head out of here, hey?
Yeah.
And maybe we'll see you next time on another brand new episode of
The Harmonious Gentleman Podcast. Harmonious Gentleman.